with an all new episode of Keep It. I'm Ira Madison III.
I'm Louis Fertel, and I literally was worried about being out of practice. It has been simply a long time since I've spoken at all. I'm like Holly Hunter in the piano. Not a peep has come out of me since last episode.
It has been a significant amount of time since we've been on the air, which is wild because I remember when we never took a day off ever.
No. In fact, we used to do multiple episodes a week. I definitely did not have more thoughts to compensate for how much more time we spent on the air. So I don't know what I said or what went down. By the way, you know what else I've been thinking about? When I set up my laptop for this, because we film up the episodes every week, I use some books to put my laptop on. And I always use this book that we got because Anthony from Queer Eye was here, his like dinner recipes book. And I barely glance at the title when I use it. And the name of the book is Anthony, Let's Do Dinner. But the let's do is in such small font that it looks just like nothing. It looks like it says at. So I always assume the book was called Anthony at Dinner, which I think is really lovely. I think you should have called it that. He's like Beatrice.
You know what? I had almost forgotten about that era where we did two episodes a week.
Again, I would love to know what we said or what nerve we had.
Journey.
Yes.
anyway, we're back and a lot has occurred. A lot has occurred. We have, unfortunately, we'll get to that in a minute, but I have an early keep it gripe. Mostly because I spent Thanksgiving in Europe. But for the first time ever, my luggage was lost, and this has truly never happened to me before ever. And so, like, I was always like, I'm one of those people who is going to be able to avoid it. But I had no luggage for like a week wandering the streets of Prague, which really felt like I was embracing the Bohemia experience.
Right. No, getting very literal about being Bohemian. And also, this feels like the beginning of like a rom-com somebody pitches, right? Like, No Luggage in Prague, starring Jude Law or whomever.
Okay, but the actual title, No Luggage in Prague, sounds like a Hallmark.
I would watch that too.
Anyway, it was dealt with, but I have a bone to pick with Delta. So,
oh my God, you sound like a ninth place drag queen complaining about Delta Airlines right now. I'm really excited. Half of Twitter is drag queens yelling at Delta. If you didn't know,
yeah. But this is actually just going to turn into Delta Works podcast where she complains about things.
Oh right, that's a good living for her. I've been proud of Delta Work ever since she went viral for all the ranting and stuff.
Plus, it reminded me of, so I was recently rewatching these two clips of one, Barbara on The View, and another of Don Lemon on CNN. And I miss the era of anchors complaining publicly about people who've aggrieved them, because Barbara complained on this episode of The View that Lindsay Lohan canceled an interview with her. And then instead decided to skip out and go to Jay Leno. And Don Lemon's that same week was him complaining about an interaction he'd had with Jonah Hill that he said was Jonah Hill was rude to him and thought he was the help at a hotel.
Oh, I know exactly what you mean. First of all, that has always been something that Kathy Griffin was in on the ground floor about, like pointing out the weird things about Barbara Walters, because she was really like, we treated Barbara Walters like she was some ivory tower academic for like 30 years. And she really is like a petty dame, like somebody who's like, oh, I remember what whomever Fidel Castro said to me that one night in 1979. I'll never forgive him for it. She's somebody who keeps score, if you will. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, that's just what's been on my mind as I've been thinking angrily about Delta Airlines. So we have, unfortunately, a sad episode this week. Partly, I don't know when this show became like the Dead Celebrity Club.
I know, but, and I kind of don't want it to be, but at the same time, the celebrities keep dying who I believe we specifically have talked about in depth. So it feels like,
yes. Well,
you have to say something, you know.
No, I mean, we're going to talk about Christine McVie this week. And truly, when I found out the news, I was at a dinner and a friend told me about it, but like within their second breath, they were like, Have you checked in on Lewis?
Also, I have to say, when this happened, first of all, the way I found out was somebody messaged me on Instagram, we're going to need to help. You're going to need to help us with the passing of Christine McVie. So immediately, I was already supposed to know. And I was behind. I think I was in rehearsal at Kimmel. So I like found out on the sly. I mean, before we get into this conversation, I just want to say many, many people have reached out to me about it. And it was incredibly touching. I don't know what to say about it. I can't stop listening to Christine McVie this past week. We'll talk about her music and Fleetwood Mac and stuff. But as much as we talk about dead celebrities on the show, I can't think of somebody that close to like my like innermost celebrity love layer that has died. You know, like like the last one would be someone like Madeline Kahn. Like that's 1999. You know, so actually was a bit of a shocking phenomenon to me, even though. The thought occurred to me that Christine McVie was sick because she just had this large estate sale. Like I was going through her like stuff she was selling, and I was like, "This isn't even that expensive. I'll buy like a Christine McVie chinoiserie end table for $100." You know, like it was on my mind.
I would probably say the last one that really sort of hit me, but I guess I don't know if I can really include like Prince and Whitney Houston mostly because they're such. Mega.
Right. So they belong to everybody.
They touched everybody.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Unless you're like Hilton Alls, you know, who just wrote his like novella on Prince, you know, like, unless, you know, like, or I think of someone like a writer like Nicole Perkins, you know, like someone who like Prince is very much part of their identity, but those people belong to everyone. We'll talk about Christine. We're all. We're going to talk about Irene Cara.
Depressing. When I right heard that, before. I was like, I just don't want to hear this. Like, she's not that old. And it's very annoying, in addition to devastating.
Yeah. Also, Kirstie Alley passed away truly last night.
Yes.
So, just that, and managed to not be like everyone online who's... RIP to Kirstie Alley has all start. Every single one starts with, politics aside, ... And I'm like, girl, we get it.
And also, by the way, that is beyond generous. To say it was only politics that was her problem, the woman was fucking unhinged. I'm sorry. It remains the same in death.
It's not like she voted for a different class president.
Yeah, okay? Right.
Like, there was a lot going on with Miss Kirstie Alley. So we'll talk about that. And then Sight and Sound released their... 100 greatest films list, and it caused controversy all throughout the film industry. And truly, I actually love when film critics get upset about things. That'll be fun to talk about.
No, I love the sound of wounded men. That's just what the internet is. You know what I mean? So it's really embracing its identity by. Squealing that whatever wasn't that Psych or not Psycho that Vertigo wasn't number one or Citizen Kane wasn't number one,
and you famously hate Vertigo.
You know what what I don't like about Vertigo is the creepiness of Alfred Hitchcock that I feel is on screen in the movie. Again, when you listen to an interview with Tippi Hedren talking about her experience with Alfred Hitchcock, I feel like the feel of Vertigo is forever altered in your mind afterwards.
And then aside from that, we have the very delightful Jim Parsons on the show this week to talk about his new film, spoiler alert, which is not about Marvel Phase 4.
or White Lotus and what's going to happen the next week. My God. And I really have to avoid Twitter at all times because of these... what people think about White Lotus, and routinely they are extremely wrong.
Not even just Twitter, Instagram. Like the minute the episode drops, there are screenshots of dialogue and important moments just like in everybody's Instagram story. So it's like a truly a minefield after an episode airs,
right?
Which, by the way, the finale airs this Sunday, so you can assume that we will be talking about White Lotus next week. And whether we like season one or season two better. I already know which way I'm leaning.
Interesting. I actually haven't decided yet. So stay tuned.
Okay. All right. We will be right back with more Keep It. If you've ever messaged a friend about a manager who won't stop texting after hours, or a coworker who keeps posting weirdly suggestive Austin Powers GIFs in Slack, you're not alone.
On Work Appropriate, author and host Anne Helen Peterson sets out to find solutions to these oddly specific yet completely universal listener-submitted questions. Whether you work in an office chair or a sixth-grade classroom, the problems may be limitless, but so are the solutions. Listen to Work Appropriate now wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes drop every Wednesday. Check it out.
The world has lost two incredible performers and all-around legends recently with the passing of Irene Wood. And we're going to give them their flowers in a minute. I feel like we should just address Kirstie Alley first.
Oh, sure. I mean, let's start with like the things that are truly amazing about her, which is replacing Diane Chambers on Cheers is the tallest order in TV history. And that she not only did it well, but never copied her for a second, never copied Shelley Long for a second. And then additionally, like, won an Emmy for it. Rebecca Howe was like an awesome character. Her, like, she had a withering, sarcastic quality that made you trust her, which that quality right there is what is so vexing about Kirstie Alley. Because in all of her comedy performances, whether she was playing it really loud and crazy, like in Deconstructing Harry, or, you know, like on Cheers, where she got to be a little bit more deadpan as Rebecca Howe, there was a groundedness to her that made you believe her. So when she then turned into this conspiracy spewing, very pro Scientology, you know, otherwise harmful and toxic Twitter presence, it just fucking sucked. Like, it's the kind of person who's like catnip for young gay men. You know, I want that, you know, funny Lauren Bacall looking lady to be the best. And then she absolutely wasn't the best, even though in about 2011, she went on a queer Twitter spree and followed a whole bunch of us. So I can say that a part of my life was occasionally receiving DMs from Kirstie Alley. And I know there are a bunch of other gays out there who feel the same way. And that was also like completely strange. Like, what? Like, you're like a Scientologist. What? You're talking to me? What? Yeah.
She was trying to collect and get rid of
it. Right. I had to look out the window. I'm like, who are these people on my porch? Yeah.
What's weird, too, is that, like, I feel like people like my mom's generation, who are even slightly older people than us, were fans of her just because, like, she was, you know, like, Black people watch a lot of TV, you know? So, like, and especially, like, a sitcom like that. Like, I feel like a lot of Black people have, like, love for Kirstie Alley from the Cheers era. And then, you know, she had her own sitcom again.
Totally.
You know?
Veronica's Closet.
And I think Veronica's Closet was hilarious, to be honest. I think it lasted, what, three seasons?
Yeah, right. It's very in the Caroline in the City era where it's like, did it last two seasons or seven? Who knows? But they were all extremely well-watched seasons since it was during that period of time where hundreds of millions watched every show every week, and they were all canceled if they didn't get 700 million. Yeah. 600 million was a no-go.
It's specifically from that era where things were, I felt like they were immediately put into syndication just because of the number of ratings they had before they would even get to like the 100 episodes that you needed for syndication. Right. And so I feel like the show was always on.
Yes, totally.
I'd be remiss if I didn't bring up Fat Actress, too.
Oh, my. Fat Actress is that bitch. What an underrated show that really showcased what she could do. You know, it's sort of in that, like, lost era of pseudo-prestige TV in the mid-2000s where, you know, you either had to buy it on DVD or something. You know, it's not something you would see in syndication, for example. So definitely go back and check that out. And also, of course, the many movies in which she was hilarious, like the Look Who's Talking movies or Drop Dead Gorgeous, you know, lots of options.
Like, I have no idea what she ever did, you know, like recently, like the day to day. But I will always remember the Stephen Hawking tweet,
which should be repeated here. It is one of the most surprising and hilarious. And I can't tell how intentionally funny she was being. I guess she was going for like righteous tribute. But when Stephen Hawking died, that's right, Stephen Hawking, Kirstie Alley tweeted, "You had a good go at it. Thanks for your input." Whatever that means. Like, she assessed all his data. Yeah, we'll deal with that later, you know?
Some of our listeners might remember how harrowing that scene was in Theory of Everything, though.
Like, when Felicity Jones is yelling at Kirstie Alley to lay off. All right. And getting into legacies that are far less checkered, Christine McVie passed away. Christine McVie, one of the most hit-making songwriters for Fleetwood Mac, the keyboardist for Fleetwood Mac. She was in several versions of the band way back when it was a blues outfit in the early 70s. She moved with them through their most kind of famous period where they produced their second self-titled album and Rumors. And she left the band after they were inaugurated into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in the late 90s, but she came back in the 2000s. And first of all, we can just talk about the vocals, which is to say she was this weird combination of very bluesy and traditional pop. Like she had a Carole King sensibility, which, by the way, already is a pretty shocking thing to thrust forward into a rock and roll band. Like it was always interesting that somebody who had a kind of unassuming presence got to be in this larger than life outfit. You know, her kind of simple, plain spoken sentimentality really had extra verb thanks to like what Lindsay gave to it, or you know, it just was an interesting juxtaposition the way she fit into the group. Specifically, also, there's something about Fleetwood Mac that I think is just doesn't get talked about a lot or seems obvious to those people who are fans, but like we don't end up saying it, which is not only did this band have three great songwriters, it also had three unmistakable and very unrelated characters in it. So you'd have the Lindsey Buckingham songs, and he's this like brooding, kind of wounded, uber masculine guy. You had Stevie Nicks, where she's constantly lost in the throes of emotions. You know, everything that happens to Stevie Nicks is a meteorological phenomenon. You know, everything is storms, everything is a landslide, everything is, you know, a bad day on a weather map is what happens to Stevie Nicks. And then you had Christine, who I think the magic thing about her for me, and we've expressed this in certain ways on this podcast, but is that she really expressed the dignity in all these deep emotions. Like even if you had your heart broken, it's not like you had to wail to express that. You could sort of just live in it and have like a sort of sophisticated and a respectful take about your own emotions. And I can't even really pick a favorite song, but I will say You Make Loving Fun is to me the heart of the Rumors album, because as much as that's a tumultuous album, you know, it's about fighting with each other, it's about these band members confronting and tearing themselves apart. To me, that song expresses why the fighting is all worth it, which is to say, at the end of the day, love when we get it is fucking rad, and we get to like, you know, sex is incredible, and when we're experiencing these big emotions together and we find it, it's such a fucking relief. There's such relief in that love song. And that is always why it'll be one of my favorite songs of all time.
Isn't that the one that's not even about John, like her husband at the time?
Correct. Yes, they're breaking up. And the story goes, he was very curious why she was writing a jubilant love song. And she, you know, not creating drama, which is the Christine McVie way, said, oh, it's about the dog. And it was really about the lighting director. It was really about their lighting director who she was having an affair with. And by the way, that lighting director stayed with them through 2019. So just a part of the Fleetwood Mac lore.
I love this band. And I like truly think that, like, you know, there's so many different eras of Fleetwood where you can sort of be like, this is my favorite era. Like, I feel like it means so much to different people for different sounds. Like, you know, like I would say that Stevie's the first part that brought me into even liking Fleetwood, you know? And then I really started liking the Christine songs a lot. I mean, you know, Little Lies, Everywhere, I'm just so enamored with like Tangle in the Night as an album, just
me
because
too.
It
That's
comes a- mm-hmm. so late in their discography, like two decades, what, after Christine even joined. It's just like someone writing the best music of their career, the best music of Fleetwood Mac's career, like on, what is it, like album 14?
Right. I mean, it's like way deep into the, you know, and they've done so many weird things by that point. You know, that's well after Tusk. It's well after just all the iterations of Fleetwood Mac, really. But yes, on that album in particular, I've brought up how obsessed I am with Isn't It Midnight, which is a Christine-written song that sounds really like a Pat Benatar jam. And the verve of it, to me, that's my number one driving song. In fact, it was my number one Spotify Wrapped song of the past year because I listen to it every time I'm driving. And that was also the day I found out Christine McVie died. So it was like doubly cruel. But yes, great song. Everywhere is amazing. By the way, I finally broke regarding Christine McVie. Like, actually had the moment where I like cried a bit when I got sent a cover of Everywhere that was live. And I want to know if you know what I'm talking about.
I don't actually. Who sang it?
Paramore. Hayley Williams did a version of it live, and it looks like they're on a boat or something, but this girl crushed it. Her choice to, like, you know, in the chorus to Everywhere, you know, there's the part. What Hayley Williams chooses to do instead is so exciting and so hit the joy of Christine McVie and Fleetwood Mac on the head. I really recommend it. It's a fabulous performance.
Oh, okay. Well, you know, me, Paramore stan, I've probably seen it before, but I'm not recollecting it. But I mean, I love Hayley Williams' voice. And I think that that's another person who I feel like has that Christine quality. Because when you listen to Paramore, you, like, a lot of people think of Misery Business, you know, that like one big, like, raucous, like, you know, like, I'm Stealing Your Man song, you know? Mm-hmm. But there are so many songs that really sort of, I think, go to what you were saying about Christine. You know, they're sort of like running away from drama. A lot of songs like by Paramore, like Playing God or Brick by Brick, Boring Brick, are just really sort of about calling out like men who are sort of self-serious and creating drama around a relationship. And I feel like they have sort of the same sort of like chill, bluesy quality. One of my favorite Christine songs is one of her early ones, I'd Rather Go Blind. She did with Chicken Shack and then re-recorded for her debut album. But like covering Etta James and sounding that fucking good, like she has this, I mean, I'm sure she was in Fleetwood Mac, so, you know, I'm like sure they were all chain smoking and doing all sorts of cocaine and everything. She even had that interview where she was like, cocaine and champagne made me perform better. But like to have such
heroic,
a smoky voice at that age is just sounds so beautiful. And when I think about Rumors too, and everyone's always sort of like, I want a Rumors movie. I want a Rumors TV show. And I hope to God we get one and that Ryan Murphy stays away from it. But I would also say, you forget how old they were. They were late 20s making Rumors. And I don't know, I think just something about rock stars from the 70s or that sort of era, like being our age now, when we look back on them, like you can only really think of them as like older or sort of like our parents and stuff. And it's just weird remembering like, no, they were the age as like, you know, the youngest people like in pop music right now making music.
And we almost did get a Christine McVie biopic once upon a time. It was supposed to be Aaron Eckhart as Dennis Wilson from the Beach Boys, whom Christine dated for a while. And then Vera Farmiga was supposed to play Christine McVie. This is a very 2011 cast list. I would have loved to see it at the time. And I hope we get some version of it. It's a very interesting pairing. Christine, by the way, it's so interesting how she's just casually one of those people who she really seemed to hang around with guys. Like her whole, like the way she got into Fleetwood Mac, like she was a big fan of the band Fleetwood Mac before she even joined when it was the Peter Green outfit. She just has that casual, like one of the guys quality, but it was also like her point of view within the band was so feminine. It's like there was an act of subversion about her, how she propelled these sentiments through this band.
There was like this interview that was going around too, of like them, you know, as it was like her and Lindsay and Stevie, you know, asking about like, you know, it was sort of a sexist interview, obviously, because it was the 70s. But it was talking about women being in the band. And, you know, like, it really is just interesting to think about not just a woman in a rock band like that at that time, but like two women who were basically like stars of the band. Like in the interview, Stevie, I think, even said, you know, well, like, the difference with other rock bands, you know, where they put like a girl in it, you know, it's like if me or Christine are sick, Fleetwood Mac doesn't go on.
Right.
People are coming to see us.
Yeah, totally. Also, it just should be acknowledged, it's completely strange that there are two women in a giant rock band. You know, It's like besides the Mamas and the Papas, when did that really happen in the 60s and 70s? I mean, like we got eventually into like the Go-Go's and the Runaways and things like that, but the way they were part of the dynamic in this band that was men and women. It just, we don't have another band like that. ABBA comes to mind, but that's like, you know, the women weren't the songwriters in that band, you know? So that's like a little bit different too.
Two things I want to bring up though. You mentioned Dennis Wilson, and another one of my favorite songs from Christine is on another one of my favorite albums, Mirage, which has my favorite Fleetwood song actually, which is Gypsy, and that's by Stevie. But Only Over You, which was written about Dennis Wilson, is such a gorgeous song. And I think it has that same quality of, not the same quality. I think it has that opposite quality of like, you make love and fun, because that was, you know, about, you know, falling in love with someone else, you know, when there's all this torment going on in your life. And this was really sort of like, I believe the song came out like right around the end of Dennis's life too. And like, he was a drug addict at the time. And, you know, he had gotten fucked up by like his involvement with the Manson family. And I think like people said that he really sort of blamed himself for becoming friends with Charles Manson and sort of introducing him to Hollywood and the music industry. And so like that sort of sent him down a dark path. But that song is really just sort of like her summing up their relationship and the good parts about it, and just sort of how there's always things that are beautiful that you remember about people who were with you. So I think that's a gorgeous song.
I love that song. And I want to point out just a couple of maybe underrated songs people don't know of Christine McVie's. If you don't know, Sky's the Limit, Love Shines is a great song by her, Save Me. She really did a great job of like adding an adult quality to the raucous celebratory vibe we already know about rock and roll. That's, I think, what was her strong suit.
And we associate Stevie so much with our relationship with Lindsey Buckingham, but I want to say underrated for me, Lindsey Buckingham, Christine McVie, that joint album that they did in 2017 is
Buckingham
so good.
McVie. Yeah,
it's
so good.
So good.
Yeah, it's that will now. Christine's actually nominated for a Grammy this year for a collection she just did called Songbird. But that, I think, will go down as like, you know, right up until the end, she was creating this like really splendid music that feels very true to both her and Lindsey. There's some video of them recording this in the booth, and when they're done recording it, the two of them share this hug that goes on so long. You can feel the years and the years of the history of there of how thankful they are that the both of them, like, that, you know, Lindsey really interprets something about Christine, and Christine can really interpret something about Lindsey, and you can sense that dynamic there and how just grateful they are that they have each other. And after all these years, after all the tumult, after all the continued fighting that happens in that band, you know, all the members always said that Christine was a balm in the group and the energy was better when she was in the group. But I think in general, they, you know, that the magic of that band is they found a way to come back together and make loving fun, you know?
Yeah. Anyway, it's her last album too that she recorded before she died. And so it is, you should listen to it if you haven't listened to it, mostly because she also talks about how, like, you know, years later, it helped her rediscover her love of music, you know?
Right. And this is somebody who spent all these years out of Fleetwood Mac because she had a deathly flight fear. She like moved to the country, like did nothing, had nothing to do with music for a long time, sort of just succumbed to phobias for a while and triumphantly came out of it. So she should be applauded for that too.
Yeah. And that's also like sort of a sad segue into Irene Cara, who talking about sort of like phobias and sort of like clues. I think there was a story today, you know, just about how in her later years, she sort of removed herself from society and was just sort of like at home, you know, and didn't like interacting with people. But to talk about Irene Cara, that music is phenomenal. It is so that is why people remember Fame. The theme song is why people remember Fame. Hot Lunch is why people remember Fame. Okay, those are like 80s anthems. And to then be able to do that again for like Flashdance and win the Oscar for it, fantastic.
Yes, total. Well, Oscar trivia people know that Irene Cara was the first black woman. She's African, Puerto Rican, and Cuban. First Black woman to win an Oscar in a non-acting category, which is among the most damning statistics in Oscar history. I want to be clear, this is 1983 that this finally happened. But when you look at the history of the Best Original Song Oscar, there are a lot of good songs. You know, you have your Over the Rainbows, you have your Moon Rivers, but there aren't so many that make you think like, yes, this song in that movie. And I think Flashdance, What a Feeling is a definitive winner. And by the way, she wrote the lyrics to that song just in the taxi on the way to go and record it. So, like, and I guess an Oscar can happen to all of us in an Uber. I have no idea. But
that's such a New York story, by the way.
I know.
It's in the taxi, and like, it feels so fame.
Exactly. It's like she was living in fame after the movie Fame came out, by the way. But there's something about that song where it's like, one, it makes you think of the movie. Mm-hmm. Two, it makes the movie better. And then three, it stands on its own. So yeah, it really has the like essential ingredients in a great win. I watched a performance of Irene's on the old David Letterman show in the early 80s. She performed Out Here on My Own from Fame, which was also Academy Award nominated and written by Leslie Gore of It's My Party fame. Yes. Ain't nobody here dislikes Leslie Gore and her brother Michael Gore. And he won the Oscar for writing the title song from Fame. So he was nominated for two Oscars that year, in addition to score, I believe. So three.
Out Here on My Own, also iconic cover by Mariah Carey, which I believe is in Glitter. Of course.
Fame is such a Mariah-ish movie. You know she was obsessed with that growing up. Yeah.
My grandmother was obsessed with watching Fame, too. It's just like, there's no way that you weren't obsessed with Fame if you aren't if you're a musician, a star, a performer who's sort of from that era. You know, if you were a teen in the 80s, like, you're obsessed with that. And I want to go back to that Oscar ceremony, by the way, because I was like, I'm sure these are all things that you know, but I was just looking up like the 83 Academy Awards because I'd seen photo of her with he was the presenter for Best Song that year, along with Jennifer Beals. And that had me looking at the presenters and performers for 83. 83 was also the Terms of Endearment winning year.
Right.
And these presenters are so hilarious to me, but it's also giving star, you know? It's like Timothy Hutton and Mary Tyler Moore presented Best Supporting Actor. We had Kevin Bacon and Daryl Hannah doing sound effects. Joan Collins and Arnold Schwarzenegger did the Academy of Scientific and Technical Awards.
These like Hirschfeld drawings of celebrities, crazy. Like major, like insane celebrities.
Mel Gibson and Sissy Spacek doing Best Screenplay.
Mel Gibson did
Best Actress.
Oh, right. Oh, my God. Yeah, Rock Hudson. I mean, that would have been very near the end for Rock Hudson. But Mel Gibson, would have been that year in The Year of Living Dangerously, because Linda Hunt won Best Supporting Actress that year.
Oh, yeah, that's right. So, you know.
And he was unbelievably hot in that movie. Anyway.
Frank Capra presented Best Picture that year.
How could he still be alive around that time? This is a man who dominated the 1930s.
and lastly, Dolly Parton and Sylvester Stallone presented the award for Best Actor.
And of course, they are the stars of Rhinestone, which, you know, not really Oscar canon, but somebody's canon.
Yeah. The other thing about Irene, I want to say, is that she got her start in Sparkle.
The soundtrack to Sparkle, I love it. It's Aretha Franklin, and she does the song Jump on that, is a particularly spicy song. I love spicy Aretha, you know, like Rock Steady, etc.
It's nice to remember those songs. As if you're gonna listen to Flashdance and Fame, you know, like her solo stuff was is full of like hits that I feel like could be played at like a horse meat disco or something, and someone would be shazamming it and be like, what is this song? It's great.
And I hope that's the case. I hope people are shazamming. Like, if you don't know Why Me by Irene Cara, great 80s supercharged banger.
When we are back, we will be joined by Jim Parsons to talk about his new film, Spoiler Alert.
Hi. I'm Alex Wagner. I do not need to tell you that being an American right now is a wild ride. But as a longtime journalist, I am not interested in the noise or the fear-mongering. I'm interested in the stories at the heart of the headlines. That is why every week on my show, Runaway Country, I'm joined by folks in the middle of the crossfire. From disillusioned MAHA moms to newly fired immigration judges to Epstein victims themselves, to understand what it means to live through this political chaos as an actual human being. And now I'm excited to tell you that Runaway Country is available ad-free to Friends of the Pod subscribers. Friends of the Pod is the subscription that supports the work Crooked does as an independent media company and gives you a ton of great bonus and ad-free content. With the midterms approaching, you are going to need more content to keep you sane. And now you can find Runaway Country right there. Subscribe now at crooked.com/friends.
You obviously know him from his most famous role in The Big Bang Theory, but as well as The Normal Heart, Hollywood, The Boys in the Band, and now his new film, spoiler alert, we are thrilled to welcome to Keep It the delightful Jim Parsons.
Hello.
Hi.
Well, I hope that's not true. But I will say, I was talking to somebody recently, and I thought, and I said, you know, when I first started working, the fear was being found out as gay. I'm old enough that that was true, to a certain degree. And then the second fear was being always cast as gay and not allowed to play straight. And I still think that's a real thing, but I will say that it has been such a blessing to play these gay characters and the types of characters and the depth of story and humanity in those things that I was doing that in has been a self awakening and journey unlike any I would have gotten if I had not played them. So in that way, it's just really funny to hear you say it like that, because I didn't know if anybody else in the world would pick up on that or could pick up on that the way I had for myself, which was that it has changed my life in a way to play those different gay characters and explore the differences in one major similarity, you know?
Yeah, and I mean, even in this film, spoiler alert, which is based on, of course, Michael Osiello's book, spoiler alert, the hero dies at the end. It's wild that I was watching it and was like, oh, it obviously plays the tropes of, you know, like a gay rom-com, but it's also about Michael's partner dying of cancer. And so you've also tapped into now maybe the first like gay Fault in Our Stars. Almost like it's a genre of like, I feel like we haven't seen, and it's, if normally it would be like my partner's dying of AIDS, but
that's right. Well, and what you say there is true. And also the opposite is true, which is that it is a genre we've seen all of our lives, but we've not really watched it with two men or two people of the same sex going through it. And I know for me, for all the ways in which I connected with the material and wanted to make the movie, that it had to do with specific ways in which I did relate to it as a gay man in a long-term relationship, more than any of it, or as much as that, was the universality of the story and the way it did line up with stories that I had grown up with loving and being moved by. It was just a little bit extra powerful for me because now it was that much easier to put myself in their shoes. But I do think that's one of my favorite things. I know it is one of my favorite things about this film, is that in one way of looking at it, gay love story is really not the headline. It really is just love story. And then they happen to be gay, you know, it really is just family and humanity. And they also happen to be gay. And that was thrilling and is thrilling to be a part of.
There's something specific about Michael Osiello that is explored in this movie that I find interesting, which is that his relationship to all of his emotions and to life is filtered through pop culture. There's an awesome scene where his partner discovers that Michael Osceola has a room full of Smurf stuff. There are several scenes in the movie where he imagines his childhood as a rom-com with all these like harrowing moments in it. And I was wondering if you related to that at all, if you sort of looked to pop culture growing up as a way to explain yourself or find yourself in life.
It's interesting. I don't see any way that I didn't. I don't see it. I don't think it's possible for me to have grown up in the time I did in our country and not. And to many degrees, still do. Still learning lessons, right or wrong, from a kind of pop culture, whatever, that may or may not actually work for you in your own personal real life storyline. I feel like for me, the biggest thing was when we came across the idea to frame Michael's childhood through the lens of an 80s sitcom. And that really felt powerful to me when we talked about that, because I just thought it was very moving and relatable, the idea of he went through some real hardships with his, you know, family before and death in the family before the whole Kit story. And it would make such sense to me that he would find a way to put it in the framework of a comforting, laugh track filled, you know, buoyancy. That was the way to be able to look at it as clearly as he could and as safely for himself as he could. But all of these points really did jump off in one way or another back to the way Michael wrote his book, which was also framed in an episodic TV type way, you know, next week on or previously on or things like that. And so he really was the impetus for where this creative train went from the beginning.
I mean, well, speaking of, you know, the sitcom flashbacks, you know, you spent so much of your life and career on The Big Bang Theory. You know, I feel like you have so many different sort of acting muscles that you've had to work out. You know, I feel like you started in theater in Houston, and then you did a sitcom, and now you're doing more dramatic roles. Sort of what does each sort of take out of you, or do you find that they're sort of similar in doing all three things?
I feel similar in that I rarely, if ever, consciously approach any job with like, now I'm trying a whole new game plan. This is different than this, so I'm going to tackle it in this different way. I have never consciously done that. Obviously, as I've grown and changed as a person, just inherently my approach probably changes. But I will say that, you know, and this sort of gets back to what we were talking about at the very beginning, the various different types of gay men I've played in the past 5 to 10 years or whatever. A lot of the roles in the last 10 years of my adult life have, and maybe it's just where I am in my own life, but they have affected my life outside of the work in a way that I don't know I was aware of for the first 20, 30 years of working or whatever, back in school, but you know what I'm saying. But again, I don't know if that speaks to the work. It probably does to some degree, but a lot of it also speaks to me and an eagerness to find new things and things like that. And it's also different to be at this point in career and life and making or trying to make more conscious choices about what I'm doing. Whereas, you know, for so many years it was, I just wanted to work, you know, and I was very fortunate. The things that I did end up working on were very rewarding and I got so much out of them. And I feel like I was able to give so much to them, but so much of it was not choice. You know, this is a fairly new development in my life of like, does this sound interesting to you? And before, like I say, interesting was like, does it pay rent? You know, that's a different way. And I think that has something to do with the way things are affecting me now and what I'm getting to do.
Also, something I'm fascinated by you about is, you have several roles, and I'm thinking of in Ryan Murphy's Hollywood, which I thought you were fabulous in Hidden Figures, where and actually a little bit in Boys in the Band, where I would describe you as scary. I mean, like, it's just there's a quality in these characters where, like, there's a taken aback quality by how whether they're self-loathing or just destructive. It's yeah. not something I would have guessed you had in you, really, you know, as like a kind of bubbly, effervescent sitcom star. Mm-hmm. And is it a pleasure to be scary in on screen?
It's a pleasure to explore. It's a pleasure to explore my best guess and working through of the reasons why those men are doing some of the things they're doing that are scary, less palatable. You know, Hidden Fig, Hollywood, and playing that agent who was so predatory was really a major moment for me as an actor. I'm not saying the way it was received or whatever, but I mean just going through that process. For one thing, there was this glorious book, and now I'm forgetting the author's name, but it's a biography about Henry Wilson, and it's called The Man Who Created Rock Hudson. And that was the first time I had played a character that I had kind of a literal Bible almost to go by about his history and what made him up and the way he worked. And that was very powerful for me. It gave me so much information that gave reasons for why he was doing what he was doing, but also gave me as an actor such a beautiful, just psychological foundation of where I was coming from. And Michael's book is not dissimilar. Not that Michael, in spoiler alert, does create scary things like that, but it was the same situation with like having a Bible for a character like that that I could go back to and always kind of place it to as deep a human places I could find. But then, which is what connects to the scary part, I do enjoy finding, I think a lot of actors do, enjoy finding that what is the humanity in them that, in order to either protect themselves or try and find what's best for them, they're trying to be happy. They want to be happy people. But so what is it that detours off into this scary land? And I guess in the name of like humanistic puzzles, there's nothing finer. There's nothing more enjoyable. Not that it's easy to play nice people necessarily. I think a lot of actors that I've watched over the years get overlooked when they play like a really well done everyman and a good guy. I don't think it doesn't look as hard. And I think that's complete nonsense. I think it's just as hard, if not harder.
Some of your recent work has been, you know, with Ryan Murphy. And I feel like we know so much about him throughout his career and how he got to be able to tell the stories that he wants to tell. But what's interesting to me is, you know, you worked on Big Bang Theory with Chuck Lorre. And I feel like as a television icon, we know his work, obviously, Dharma and Greg, you know, we know Sybil, Grace Under Fire. But, you know, I don't feel like we know much about him as sort of like a storyteller the way that we do like a Norman Lear or like an Aaron Spelling. Like, was there something about working with him for so many years that sort of like showed you like why this person has created so many successful sitcoms, or like something you learned being on the show early on that sort of like told you like, this is how this show is going to keep going?
Yeah. Well, there were two major things, and they're certainly related. This is just my opinion, but I think the reason that Chuck has been as successful as he's been with these shows is that he has an incredible sense of rhythm and musicality. And I think that's valuable in a lot of these art forms, be it theater, movies, or television, but it's especially valuable when you're talking about these half-hour sitcoms. And like I always said, I feel like he's a master at being able to hear an episode of TV almost play like a good pop song. It's something you can listen to again and again. It goes by at a certain beat, you know, you can dance to it, as it were, or laugh to it. And that affects his overall view. It certainly did for our show, every single episode. I said this too. I said, if you watch any episode of our show, there's always this moment at the end where, or almost always, where the blackout with his name appearing comes just almost a half beat too soon. It almost kind of gets you on the edge of your seat in a way. And I always thought it was genius. I was just like that. It just gives you that sensation of, oh, it's over. And like, you want more. And I don't think it's trickery, but I think it's a good ear and a good rhythm. The second thing though, that, you know, got him to where he is that it's very important. It can be very important to have one major eye, one major voice running a show. And even though plenty of other people rose up, especially like a Steve Millar was really our showrunner by then, but even that was under the Chuck umbrella. And until you have a lot of power, or until you create that power for yourself, it can be hard. And a lot of other opinions can dilute the product, as it were. And when we were with him, he was the top guy, and the where the buck stopped from day one. And that allowed us to really execute this vision. It just happened to resonate with people, thank goodness. But the vision was never in question as far as like, oh God, a bunch of opinions from other executives and stuff are going to start. They were like, no, they trusted Chuck. He trusts himself. And that's where we went forward. And that's enormous. There's, you know, that's a lot of, that's a confident groundwork to be coming from.
Now, obviously, some of that musicality would come in the editing, but I imagine acting in the show, you must be playing to, you know, this Lydia Tarr type person's sense of rhythm when you're creating a show. And I imagine that can be super daunting or to pick up initially. Is that something you had to kind of find over time?
No, actually, which didn't mean it wasn't daunting, but it was how I felt immediately that I didn't know if they would end up casting me, but I felt that it was a really good part for me. And I thought I believe this could happen. We'll see. But it had everything to do with that. There was something that they'd written in the way he was talking and the way their scenes went. And I felt that I could hear it. I thought I could hear what they were going for. But what's funny is that it is a double-edged sword. There is such joy in getting such joy in feeling like I was getting those rhythms right and getting with them what they wanted. And there were other times that and I've experienced this a lot more lately with some single camera work. You do different takes different ways or whatever. And it's a different set of muscles because it's not a rigidity that we had that I felt I had in the sitcom, but I did feel I was serving the idea of the rhythm and I was. And it's different in other work. It's different in this movie. It's different in the play I'm doing right now or whatever. I don't want to say it's exactly a more free, but it's just another way of exploring. But that being said, in that rigidity, in that maze that they'd set up, there is a great freedom because you know what points you have to hit. And in that, it can be really, really fun. It was really fun. It was always really fun in that way. Yeah, but they're different.
Yeah, it feels like even like the syllables of what you're saying are blocked to a certain extent on Big Bang Theory.
Without a doubt, you know, and I beat myself up one side and the other, getting those lines down as much as I could, because I was like, there was no space for I mean, it just didn't exist, you know. If I didn't know what to say next, we just had to stop, and then I could start over. But trying to like sigh and humanize your way through, it was never going to work. I did crave that at a certain point. I was like, oh God, please just let me roll my eyes or something for a minute, and it's fine, you know.
You're currently also in, I think you said, a play right now. That's Terrence McNally's A Man of No Importance. Yes. Sort of, was Terrence's work something that you were obviously heavily familiar with while you were, you know, doing theater in Houston? And was this sort of like a joy to be able to act in one of his plays, you know, so soon after his death?
Yes, it definitely was. I had grown up obviously hearing the name Terrence McNally my entire life, in theater and whatever, all the plays he'd written. And in the last 8 years or so of Terrence's life, that we have been in slight communication over trying to get something going, either revival of something or whatever. And it never worked out. And when he passed away, you know, I don't think Terrence took it as a regret to his grave, but I felt regretful. I was like, I regret that didn't happen. And so when I got this notice about this play, I did not know it. It's A Man of No Importance. It's also a musical. I had never heard it. I had never seen it. Terrence had written it. All I knew was that John Doyle was directing it. And I don't know if you know John Doyle's work, but like he did the Sweeney Todd on Broadway and Company on Broadway. They're just phenomenal.
The instrumental ones.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
And gorgeous. So I want to work with John, you know. And then I opened up the play to read it, and I was like, oh, my God, Terrence wrote the book for this. And then I found out one of my closest friends is director Joe Mantello, and he had directed the original production. Mm-hmm. And then I found out that the role I was being asked to do was originated by Roger Reese, who had passed away several years ago, and I'd worked with him at the Old Globe. And it was just like, it was one of those moments of going, you're going to do this. This is everything is telling you, just do it. So here I am, and it's been a wonderful life-changing experience. It really has.
Oh, man. Have you ever read Love, Valor, Compassion? I was a late comer to that play. And over the pandemic, several friends and I like read it over Zoom. And it's like, for as a gay guy, it's weird sometimes to read like lines that you would actually say. Like, I would make that same joke about whomever, Barbara Stanwyck or whatever, you know? It's like, it's weird to feel that scene, you know?
It is. And it is. It's such a beautifully written play. And I have a very deep connection with it because when I was 20, 21, kind of coming out of the closet in Houston, you know, and this is in the early 90s, AIDS is still a very scary. I mean, I still think it is, but it was very scary as a young gay man to start feeling out your sexuality and AIDS hovering there. And I remember seeing a production at the Alley Theater in Houston of Love, Valor, Compassion, and I both loved it, and it scared the shit out of me because it dealt so frankly with someone dealing with that, with all of them as a group dealing with that. And my palms sweat a little bit just talking about it with you. Like, I'm remembering sitting in there and going, I love this, and I'm a little scared being confronted with this. But anyway, this just all speaks to the impact Terrence had.
Yeah, and Joe also directed my favorite Terrence play, The Ritz. I saw that, the revival with Rosie Perez in it back in 2007.
Oh, yeah. I've never seen it.
Yeah. It was fantastic. As someone who grew up in, you know, working in theater so much, and now, obviously, I would assume, you know, you have the ability to sort of work with roles that interest you now, and maybe pick even a play that you would want to shepherd to off-Broadway or Broadway. Are there any roles that you have played before that you are really excited to maybe do again, or a play that you've like, I've always wanted to play this, but I hope I get the opportunity to?
Honestly, not so much. I've never been very good at that. It's not that nothing's ever interested me, but the few times it has, and I've brought it up to somebody, it rarely seems to go anywhere. You know, now new material, spoiler alert, is a great example. That was something that me and my company got the rights to, and it turned into this. But it's something like you say, like a role that I've always wanted to play or whatever. I feel like a couple of times I brought it up to people I trusted or whatever, and it's never taken off for some reason. And I think there's just something about the way I work or who I am and the way people work with me that it needs to be a much more collaborative decision. There's something slightly inorganic about me. I know a lot of people do it, but for whatever reason, something slightly inorganic about me saying, no, I want to play this and I want you to direct it. And I think part of it is that I really want to feel everyone is on board from a very deep place and interested in it. I would be not as comfortable knowing somebody was doing something, even if they wanted to. Part of it was because they knew they were doing it for me because I wanted them to do it with me. And maybe I'll keep growing and changing and I'll develop that more. But I do love entering a room knowing everybody's there for some, maybe even slightly mysterious personal reason. Like you can never know for sure what it is exactly they connected to about this to be in this room.
I think if you're firm and you just say, look, it's me, Jim Parsons, I'm going to be playing Amanda Wingfield in The Glass Menagerie, and you all have to accept it, and that's that. I think people just jump on board. I don't know what you're so self-conscious about.
I think that's a different fight. I think that it would be willing to make that fight, going, God damn it, we're doing this. Outlandish has never been a problem. It's the nuance that I get, you know, touchy-feely.
I guess maybe last question. Obviously, in this film, you get to work with the iconic Sally Field.
You know, of course,
like,
yes.
how is that like being on set with her? Lewis and I have met Sally because we're friends with her son, Sam. But to be able to act with her.
Yeah. It was breathtaking, to be honest with you. And not because she was doing things right and left. And you're like, oh, look at her go. But it comes with a history, you know, it comes with a very, if you're an actor, especially, I think it comes with a very powerful history. She's someone that you've not only grown up with, but she's top tier of actors you admire and strive to bring your version of that kind of power and passion that she's always brought to her things. And breathtaking in the normalcy of sitting there off set with her and talking about life, scenes, the dog, whatever, and that kind of thing, and how, you know, it's one of those moments where it's shocking and also a huge relief to realize that somebody that you've admired so much is just an actor. and as gifted as she is, she's just going through the same rigmarole that we all are, and she's doing it for some overlapping similar reasons, a desire to storytell, a desire to experiment and play with these other emotional aspects of being human. And then, you know, she's just her. But few people bring the kind of gravity to any scene she walks into that she does. I'll say that. It's instantaneous. And I think it's probably something she's always done, but it's definitely something she's multiplied in intensity, I imagine, over the years from working so much. And I'm just so damn grateful she did the movie. I mean, it adds her mere presence in it. And I don't mean name wise, although there's certainly that, but just her mere presence as an actor in this film elevates it and again, lends a depth of humanity to it that some aspect would not be there as much if it weren't her doing it, you know?
There is just an extraordinary normalcy quality to Sally Field, 2-time Oscar winner. I'm just saying, if you sat down with Glenda Jackson, she's going to be a little bit hair-raising with you. You know what I mean? Whereas, like, Sally just immediately locks in.
It's true. Well, Sally is always a joke, like, everyone's mother, Sally Field. And it's funny because I feel that, and there is truth to that. But if I'm allowed to say this in the same, what a sex pot. I mean, you go back to like Smokey and the Bandit or whatever. It's like, that's nobody's mother. That is, she's just, so she's, you know, but I think that too, it all goes in this whole capsule of like, she's worked long enough and done so many different things and done them so deeply and so well that she is a human and a woman who she kind of brings all of that with her. And that's part of the power, is you know all of that's there. She's not simply this. She's not simply that. She is a very layered human being. And yeah, yeah. Any idiot could have told you that, but I just did it for you.
Well, thank you so much for being here, Jim.
Thank you for having me. It's really been a pleasure.
What a pleasure. Yes, thanks. Come on back anytime. With or without Sally.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Mitch Landrieu.
My name is Erin Haynes.
My name is Jennifer Palmieri, and we're hosting a new series called Long Play. The South is the new political epicenter of the country. Democrats are way on their heels in this region, but Republicans are going through their own reckoning in the South, too.
I mean, the South has always shaped American politics. We know that.
The stakes could not be higher, but to win the South, you have to understand it.
People in the South feel really misunderstood, left behind, put down on, and they want to explain that to somebody.
We're traveling across 6 southern states to explore the people, the issues, the assumptions that no longer hold, and what the rest of us are missing about a region that will shape the future of our politics and our country. From Left, Right, and Crooked Media, starting July 27th, watch Long Play Series on YouTube at youtube.com/longplayseries or listen wherever you get your podcasts.
As 2022 comes to a close, it's time for everyone's favorite end of the year tradition. getting mad at a list someone posted online.
I love it so much. It's the least productive anger ever. I love it. Yes.
Sight and Sound has released the definitive greatest films of all time, and the reactions have been mixed, and some of them have been wild. We can say that, you know, listen, most of the reactions are coming from the fact that there's a new number one on the list. This is sort of their longest running critics poll, and they sort of do it like every decade, and people get to submit their own top 10 lists. And this year, Chantal Ackerman's Jeannie Dillman, 23, Croix de Commerce, 1080, Bruxelles, took the top spot. It's the first film from a female director to achieve the honor since the poll began in 1952. And the girls are tussling.
Good. Yeah, and it's also the only the fourth movie ever to be ranked number one. Previously, Vertigo had gotten it, Citizen Kane, and Bicycle Thieves. I mean, it does feel completely out of nowhere to me, much as everybody loves the director, Chantal Ackerman. And also, it's a very... The movie is very interesting, even just the description of it, before you get into how insular and like bracing it is as a film. But it's a woman who's a widow, and her life is extremely regimented. Like, everything down to the hour occurs the same every day. And after her husband dies, she maintains, she's a prostitute from 5 to 5:30 every day. And certain things start to slip up. They're like things in the routine that change, and the movie is about what happens when, you know, these slip-ups continue to occur. I won't spoil it beyond that. To me, what's always the most fascinating about this poll is what falls off the list, because seemingly for no reason, people just get sick of, you know, ballyhooing certain movies. Like, I guess, you know, like what fell off, like The Godfather 2 fell off the list. Really interesting. Why? You know, it just people got sick of sticking up for it, or what? You know, Fanny and Alexander, the great Bergman epic.
Yeah.
Chinatown, Nashville. In fact, I think someone said there's no Altman on the list at all, which is, for me, bone-chilling.
Mm-hmm. I think what really happens, too, and, you know, like, there's people who are very upset about it, like Paul Schrader, who I adore, so I'm not going to drag him on this show. But I did really hate him being like, this was a example of like the list going too woke, because I hate when people use the, you know, like, you sound like fucking Ron DeSantis, for one.
Yeah, totally.
And two, it makes sense, because, you know, we finally have more critics of color and like female critics, and obviously they're going to champion the films that they care about. And Jeannie Dillman, like, has really sort of become this like cult classic, you know, amongst like a certain set of film critics at a certain point. And like, it makes sense that that would jump up. You know, is it still going to be at number one in 10 years? I doubt it, you know, but something else probably will. And I do want to say that, and I think Big Guy Lodge tweeted this, like, if you don't think that some of the best films ever are currently being made now, then like, what are we even doing here? You know?
Right.
Totally. Obviously, Jeannie Dillman is, you know, from
70s.
1975. But, you know, like, there were people mad that, like, Portrait of a Lady on Fire was, like, up there on the list, you know? And it was, like, Portrait of a Lady on Fire, Moonlight, you know? It's like, yeah, we every year we should be striving to, like, make some of the best films that have ever been made. And, like, if a film comes out and it's fucking amazing and it's 2022, like, you know, lists are arbitrary anyway, but it's like, I'm not going to fight about whether or not, you know, like, Moonlight's better than fucking Chinatown, you know? Like,
yeah, right. Also, by the way, just that entire vibe. First of all, if you're a fan of Paul Schrader, I recommend not reading his Facebook, just ever. But secondly, like, the whole, like, idea that, like, oh, you're really killing the vibe by bringing in these new movies or whatever, or you're full of shit or whatever. It's like, what you're saying is it's just no fun for you to, like, be into a movie that's, for example, about women or about people of color, you know? It's like,
or queer people.
Because, like, by the way, there are so many films in this list that you're going to necessarily disagree with and just say, like, oh, I don't really like that one as much as I like this other one. Why are these the sticking point? Like, can we take 2 seconds to think about why it's really, like, you know, you can't get over these two? It's just really annoying, and I think transparent.
It's also just, like, I don't know, as someone who comes from, like, theater, too, you know? It's like, there are constantly new plays being made that are fucking amazing. And like, The whole point of being an artist and a writer and a director is to say something about the human condition. And I would just have to think that a film being made now says a bit more about the human condition than Raging Bull.
Right, right.
It's just an amazing film, but like, you know, like we have moved past how we thought about society and about how we thought about men and everything else, like from like the 70s, you know, like you should expect that newer films are going to pop up on the list. You're going to expect that also, like, we're going to stop talking about certain films as time passes. And it doesn't mean they're not great anymore. And like I said, like, it's a fucking arbitrary list, but at a certain point, like you can't put every film that's ever made on the list, you know? So like, right. You have to start like moving with what people are interested in watching. I'm sure, you know, people making films in the 70s, you know, like those films before they were considered cult classics or, you know, just sort of like AFI's best films, you know, like I'm sure people were like, oh, this isn't Bicycle Thieves.
Right. I think something that also sticks with me is like, I grew up on these like AFI lists of the 100 greatest movies, which were, they did one in the 90s and then did an update of it in the 2000s. And they largely resembled each other. But something that has always stuck with me is that, like, you know, for instance, like The Godfather is always near the top, or Lawrence of Arabia is always near the top. Not on the Sight and Sound list, by the way. Lawrence of Arabia fell off. But I think something
not on
that
Julie Dash's list.
Yeah, right.
Julie Dash's 10, she was like Lawrence of Arabia.
I think something that sticks out to me is that even though nobody would argue that like The Godfather isn't artful or whatever, it's also like men are interested in themselves, and so they get to then mistake that for having taste. When it's like, if The Godfather were about women, I'm not saying I need that movie. I'm not saying like I want the Ocean's 8 of Godfather, whatever. It's like, you just wouldn't be as interested in it, even if it were the same amount of artfulness within the film. So I think when I look at a lot of these lists of old movies, it's like men choosing to believe their own stories, and namely white men choosing other white men, is the best. It's like touting whiteness. I mean, I think that's what it's about, and touting being a white man.
I love The Godfather, but I'm also like, if we're talking about a Coppola film, you know, I'm like, where's Peggy Sue?
Please. I mean, now we're speaking my language. My God, what a great performance from Kathleen Turner. But again, I think men being interested in themselves conflated with prestige has always happened thanks to these lists. And I feel like interrupting that is something that's kind of rad. Like I'm sort of thrilled to hear like other things break through the ranks and people have to actually consider, you know, the points of view that don't fit into that column.
To quote Glass Onion, we're the disruptors.
By the way, Glass Onion, I liked better than the first Knives Out. I saw that over the break.
I did too. I'm going to talk about that more later with the episode, but like, I fucking love Glass Onion. And I think that is a thing about what movies do for you, by the way, because when Knives Out came out, you know, I was obsessed with that movie. I loved it.
Yeah.
It took Knives Out 2, Glass Onion, for me to see Rian Johnson improve on what he did in Knives Out. And now I enjoy that one so much better. And it makes my opinion of Knives Out, which I do still love, like lower a bit because I'm like, this movie's better than it.
Yeah, right. Which egotistically you can handle. That's nice to see. I love that. Wow. Set an example for the Sight and Sound people.
But, you know, I feel like each director, a new movie that they make, you know, should be like improving, you know, if it's not improving on what they did before, it should have something different to say. And I think, you know, mentioning Peggy Sue Got Married, like I said, or, you know, like even the Scorsese films that are on this list, you know, like I love Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore, you know? And I think that what we're seeing now is, especially like this coming from someone who went to NYU for film school, you know, I think that you get tired of not just these AFI lists, you get tired of being in film school and hearing constantly people tell you what the best movies are. And those have never changed. Someone is always mentioning the same, like the top 10 has always seemed the fucking same. You could write out a list, you know, with your eyes closed. You know, and you could sort of guess what the list would be. I think that's also why people were dragging Ty West's list. Ty West, the director of Pearl and X. And his list was very just sort of basic.
The canon, like down the line, like famous movies. Like, what was it? Psycho and
Hold on. Psycho, Citizen Kane, Godfather, 2001, Apocalypse Now, Sunset Boulevard, Chinatown, Jaws, Taxi Driver, Easy Rider. Like, sure.
Yeah, right. We've all seen those. Yeah, yeah.
which is so.
And by the way, people don't dislike those movies. Like, it is just weird to see them all immediately chosen, though. It's like funny.
Well, you know? I think it's what's actually funny about it. And what's funny about this whole Sight and Sound list in general is people were angry at his list because they felt it was basic and they felt that like it didn't tell you anything about him as an artist, the films that he picked. But then on the flip side, you can't be angry if the list then doesn't represent where art and criticism is now, because every individual critic picking a list is going to pick films that like represent their sensibilities.
Yeah, in a way, I guess it's sort of admirable that he pulled himself out of it. I mean, and was quote unquote objective about what he chose. But of course, nobody's objective. Anyway, lists are fun to argue about.
So I made a personal top 10 list.
About that. Are they actually like tiered? Is it like one means the most and 10 means 10th best?
I would say, actually, yes.
All right, I'm ready to shoot this down.
Okay. Yes, mine actually is tiered. Number one is All About My Mother, Almodovar.
I mean, you would think we saw a little bit more of him in these rankings. He really is an astounding living artist, and I can't even, like, Penelope Cruz in Parallel Mothers last year, he, like, did it again. Like, he really comes back again and again with these, like, juicy, I would call his movies succulent.
Mm-hmm. That's a perfect word for his movies, actually.
Thank you so much.
I would say that him, like, as, you know, like, he's like, old guard at this point, but because his movies have so many women in them, because they're so queer, and because they're just, you know, like, outwardly in your face with being, like, faggy movies, you know, men who make these other lists, you know, like, don't necessarily relate to and Almodovar film.
And I recommend they get on it because it's a good time.
Number two would be Eve's Bayou by Casey Lemon.
I absolutely knew Eve's Bayou was coming up. I had my Journey Smollett take already. She's great in Eve's Bayou.
We know that's a fucking keep it classic. We're always talking about Eve's Bayou. Another keep it classic is number three, Written on the Wind by Douglas Sirk.
Oh yeah, where I think still the only movie where somebody is mamboed to death. And, you know, there should be an entire industry about that.
Four is Mildred Pierce by Michael Curtis.
Oh, please. First of all, everybody in that movie, I mean, it's famous for being a Joan Crawford vehicle, but Eve Arden in that movie, Anne Blythe, who is still with us. I think maybe ever since Angela Lansbury died, that's the person in the earliest nominated performance who's still alive, Anne Blythe and Mildred Pierce.
Is that the film that she was nominated for?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Five would be, and this was hard because I love Hitchcock. And I was like, which one do I pick? I picked Psycho.
Well, let me tell you, the last time I watched Psycho, I really am shocked by how many of the choices seem downright contemporary. Like, the pacing of the scary moments is really... feels really modern, which is, I mean, you know, it's this black and white movie from 1960 starring, you know, quintessentially 1960 people like Anthony Perkins and Martin Balsam and Janet Leigh, et cetera. But it in a way, different than all other Hitchcock movies, it stands out as full of modern choices.
And because I think it's so about the voyeurism of Norman Bates that it sort of fits into Hitchcock's filmography, but it doesn't feel gross, I guess, like you were saying before, like thinking about like how he treated Jimi Hendrix on set, you know, like the whole point of Psycho is that it's exploitative.
Yeah, right. And he's right. Obviously the last 10 minutes of Psycho are somebody looking to camera and explaining why this person is deranged.
And I think that's bonkers and a beautiful film choice. I fucking love it. It's so Bond. Yeah. It's just like another film, number 10 on the list, actually does that too, but in a more modern way. But I will get to that. I say number six is All About Eve by Mankiewicz.
Oh my God. I mean, like, I'm never done loving All About Eve. I think I think something that like makes a movie legendary to me is there are great lines I keep forgetting. You know, it's not just the two great lines. There's like 25 great lines in All About Eve, and all of the characters get are specifically their own entities. You know, Celeste Holm is not like Bette Davis, who is not like Thelma Ritter, et cetera, or Anne Baxter. But they all get these sophisticated moments to be witty and observant about other characters in the movie. It's just, it remains one of a kind. So fast. And of course, the wonderful George Sanders and his wonderful voice.
I mean, I think that too is why I love like mysteries or like even a film like A Glass Onion, right? Like it's part about ensemble pieces. Isn't just each character getting to comment on the other characters in the film.
Totally, totally. I think that's one of the thrills of it. And like, for instance, like a movie like Clue, I think that's one of the, like, mm-hmm. you know, Miss Scarlet, like getting to like roll her eyes at Colonel Mustard or whatever, you know, there's lots of interplay between the characters. I also want to say about Glass Onion, clearly a shout out to The Last of Sheila, the Stephen Sondheim and Anthony Perkins written mystery from the 70s, where a millionaire invites his strange, suspicious friends on a puzzle caper that ends up going awry.
Seven. It's a Spielberg film. Can you guess which one?
Yeah, I bet I can. Hold on. I don't know that you would say E.T., but I'll say E.T.
Jurassic Park.
Oh, interesting. I mean, we love it, Jurassic Park. I've probably seen more than any other. E.T. is the movie I've seen the most. But Jurassic Park is the one that would come on TV the most among Spielberg movies.
I would say E.T. came on TV a lot, but I was never hooked into E.T. the way I was hooked into Jurassic Park. My grandmother always reminds me of how fucking obsessed I was with dinosaurs.
Oh, it was unavoidable in that time. Yeah.
I was taken at a certain point, I was just dropped off at the movie theater in Milwaukee because I saw Jurassic Park every weekend.
And that's turned you into the person you are today. You're actually dressed like, what's her name in that movie? Ellie Sackler. I assume your shirt is tied in the middle.
Also, that's just like, I feel like that just tells you about, like, that's why I'm excited to see the Fablemans too. I just feel like that just is like such a symptom of Spielberg and movie magic. You just sit down and you watch Jurassic Park and you feel like you're watching a film and you're transplanted to a world. Like, that's what made me love movies.
I did not love the Fablemans, I have to say, and I didn't love Michelle Williams in it either, but we'll get into that another week.
I haven't seen it yet, but it just opened up in theaters here, so I'm going to see it, and then we can talk about it. So, number eight is West Side Story, the original.
I mean, if you watched West Side Story alone, you might be fooled into thinking Natalie Wood is among the worst people we ever propelled to stardom, but she's not. She's great in many movies. But, of course, Rita Moreno, of course, George Chakiris, yes.
Nine is Wong Kar-wai's Happy Together.
Oh, that's what you chose, as opposed to any of the other Wong Kar-wais that usually dominate these listy roundups.
Yeah, I mean, listen, I could have gone with In the Mood for Love, I could have gone with Chungking Express, but you know what? I'm like, I saw that movie only a few years ago, but it really just sort of like hooked me, and I haven't been able to get it out of my brain ever since. I think it's a really beautiful love story too, and it's about two men, so... it's my In the Mood for Love.
Okay, very good. In the Mood for Our Love. Yes.
We love a different way. We talk a different way. Happy Together is an alien superstar, okay?
Yes.
and 10 is the one that I said is a little bit like Psycho, in that it explains everything at the end, but 10 is Scream.
Oh, yes. I think Scream remains one of the most pleasurable movies I've ever seen, and I feel that way every time I watch it. It's almost like if you only had the comedy in that movie, it would still be its own movie. If you only had the horror in that movie, that would still be its own perfect. But it's this mesh of personalities and like very Gen X cynicism and genuine scares. You know, just everybody is their A game, and I mean, like I would die for Neve Campbell. Like, I don't know that I would have ever said that in my lifetime. Neve Campbell is, like, absolutely essential.
It reminds me of Ryan Johnson talking about Agatha Christie books. I went to this talk that he had about Glass Onion at Vulture Fest. And he just talked about how people, you know, put Agatha Christie into this sort of, like, you know, they pigeonhole her. But really, every book is sort of, like, a different genre. And, like, you know, there's, like, the ABC... Murders, which was sort of like the ABC Murders, which is so different. And then there's and then there were None, which is very much like slasher. And it's, I feel like Scream operates as a horror film, a comedy, but also it's just like a really good whodunit. You know, I feel like the slasher element, you know, in those earlier slashers that were inspired at like Prom Night and shit like that, it's like, you know who the killer is, really, or like, you know why they're doing it. And what's beautiful about Scream is like, you don't know the motive for the murders. And you're also, you're trying to figure out the motive and you're trying to figure out who did it. And then the end scene in the house, you know, with Stu and Billy is really sort of just like drawing room, Perot, Columbo moment, but reversed because the killers are holding them captive and they're explaining why they did everything. And I think it's just sort of like a really beautiful movie that changed a lot about the horror genre. And things that came after it. And if horror was given more respect, I think that Scream would have a lot more honors and would be higher on people's lists.
I also, just in general, it makes me realize that there aren't too many movies that you can say are classic whodunits. You know, it's just like mystery is not really a genre that, I don't know, has fared well over time or that we've even attempted that much. I remember when the AFI did a list of the best mysteries ever, like Vertigo came in at number one, and that is technically a mystery. I mean, like, what you find out at the end explains a whole lot, but it's not really like a whodunit like that. You know, it's not that classic thing of there's these seven people and it's one of them or what, you know. So to get that in the form of Scream is fabulous. And of course, I thank Rian Johnson for being obsessed with that genre itself, you know, for giving us more of that thing I don't think we've had enough of historically.
Yeah, he's found his niche and he's stuck with it. So Definitely. That's my list. That's my top 10, you know, I think probably I'm like,
I think I'm proud of you.
Thank you. I was like, I was close to like either putting like Spike Lee's Crooklyn or De Palma's Blowout on it, but I'm happy with the list.
Of course, mine would be, let's see here. Little Giants, which if you haven't seen Rick Moranis at his best, you've got to think, get going. Get your sights and your sounds on Little Giants. No, I'm kidding. I'll come up with my 10 some other week.
I have not thought about Little Giants in forever.
My brother Mark is obsessed with it and it just came to mind. I think he had a date one time where he put on Little Giants. I was like, that was either really alpha or really incel. I can't tell what that is. So,
all right, when we're back, it's time for Keep It. And we are back with our favorite segment of the episode. It's Keep It. I know what your Keep It is already, so I'm going to let you get to it. And you know I am diametrically opposite.
Okay, well, this is exciting. A real Frost Nixon moment. My Keep It is to people who are obsessively annoyed about the AI Instagram phenomenon. Okay, I'm not here saying everybody needs to download the Lensa app or we need to give all our data to whatever mysterious entity is mining it. I just think, for Instagram, which, correct me if I'm wrong, is about posting photos from your life, usually of yourself, we're routinely sick of seeing the same picture as in literally an iPhone photo of people. This, in which you see like these comic book renderings of people that are generated through AI. And I'm not saying that's even ethically done. I hear that like they're stealing art from artists, which then helps them generate the AI. I'm not supporting that either. I just think seeing whatever your best girlfriend from high school look like RoboCop is pretty cool. Like I'm into it. My friend Elise posted a bunch. I was almost in tears. I was like, oh my God, you look, I this is exactly what I think of you. You're this heroic to me. I'm not saying there aren't a ton of people posting them and that, you know, if you open up your feed, it's not 100 people posting photographs. But by the way, they're not even repetitive. The AI is so intrinsic that you get a different looking thing every time. So it's not like I'm seeing the same artist caricature every time I open up the app. So I just think it's a way to, like, you know, oh, people look cool or their ripped bodies now look like cartoon ripped bodies or whatever. I thought it was a good look for Instagram.
I've never seen this side of you.
Which is?
You talking about your friend Elise? No, like that actually moved me.
I mean, it's true.
I don't know where you are this week, but I feel like this is a lovely side of Lewis.
But it's sort of like, you know, like on Saturday Night Live when they come back from commercial and you see a picture of the host in a way you don't normally see them. It's like super artistic, or it's a fun photograph, or whatever. It's like that, you know, like, oh, what a cool way to look at this person I already thought I knew.
You've almost convinced me.
Yeah.
And but what's I will say, day five, I was like, let's wrap it up. And nothing to me has symbolized more us becoming our parents than this. And like, it just felt like such old person on Facebook behavior.
Oh, okay, kind of, yeah.
And I missed the grid post, because truly we have needed grid posts back on Instagram. And I was glad everyone was posting to grid again.
Yeah, no, it does feel like that part of Instagram is going away, and I don't want it to. It's like how I sort of absorb information better on the app, I think. But also, it's like, it to me, the strange thing about being annoyed with this phenomenon is, so what exactly do you think is essential to Instagram? Because most of what people do is pretty fucking annoying. Like, don't worry, guys, we'll get back to, like, buff guys doing 3 push-ups while lip syncing in just a second. That's not annoying. Like, it's so interesting to me.
I will actually say, but like, I'm living in my truth, in that I was annoyed about it, but I'm only expressing it here. This is the first time I've ever expressed it, because it's even more annoying than the people doing the AI were the people who then had to post that they were annoyed that people were posting AI. And then that, I was just sort of like, I don't care enough to like make a whole Instagram post about how I'm annoyed with all of my friends.
Yeah. Also, of course, like, gay Twitter went to the like dysmorphia place. Like, this is like blank, like, this is bad for like our body image and blank, blank, and blank. You literally look like RoboCop. Like, who looks at a picture of RoboCop and thinks like, oh fuck, I need to be that? Like, what are you talking about?
Also, like, no shade, but like, half of the people gays follow online to contribute to body dysmorphia. So
right, like, yes, it's not, it didn't start that. Now. Yes, right. Yes, yes. This, you looking like Ace and Gary from the ambiguously gay duo in a cartoon, is not like ruining my day. I don't know. It's so interesting.
Unfollow all the Barry instructors you follow. Okay, maybe then your brain will be a little bit better. Yeah. So I'm like, it annoyed me, but I wasn't so annoyed that I had to comment about it.
God, so I won that. Okay, great. Ira, what is your keep it?
My keep it is to Netflix.
Oh, for?
For the release of Glass Onion.
It really is perplexing to me. It really is.
For a company that seems to be like fat, nasty, broke at its lowest, Glass Onion came into theaters mad as hell. It's good.
Yeah.
It's getting rave reviews. Audiences were like eating it up. To release it for one fucking week, and then I guess we'll just watch it on Netflix on Christmas, is leaving so much money on the table. And it was like, I thought Netflix needed the money. I thought they were like hitting up people for cash at this point. Yeah. So what's not clicking here? I'm not getting it. I was extra mad because, you know, I was on vacation. I was in fucking Milan, and I am like frantically just searching online, like, how do I see this movie? Because I heard it was playing in some places in Europe that weren't the UK. And luckily it was playing at a theater in Milan. The first one I went to, it was not playing in English and had no subtitles. And then I found one that was, and this was truly like the second to last showing of the night on the last day that the movie was available. So like, by the grace of God and Sagittarius season, I got to see Glass Onion in an Italian movie theater, which was great. But I'm just like so pissed off that I had to be scrambling like I was in a fucking amazing race to see this movie. Like, it should have still been playing this week.
Also, I just want to say about this movie in particular, I feel like people who see it in a theater get a way better experience out of this movie than you do watching it just at home, where like, you want, like, it's such a goofy movie, you know what I mean? Like, everybody has a crazy occupation and these crazy characters, and where Edward Norton lives is like insane. You want to hear people reacting to those things. Whereas when you're just watching it at home, like, it's not something like, I don't know, like White Lotus or Game of Thrones or something, where I feel like people can just sit with it. It needs to be a rowdier atmosphere. I just think it plays way better in a theater.
I will say that White Lotus is so popular because it is a soap opera, and Mike White knows soap operas, you know? And it's the best part about a soap opera is that the plot is languid, you know? Like, it takes a while for the plot to unfurl. You're really sort of repeating character beats and really just sort of like living in the vibes of it. That, or like a House of Dragon, like you can watch that and sort of like your attention can dip in and out because it doesn't really matter if you focus on everything, you
right?
know? But
yes.
A film like mm-hmm. this, like this is cinema, you know, like this is, it's so much more fun in a theater watching it with people. And I'm not spoiling anything about this movie, but what I do want to say is that the twists in this movie, I think, can be ruined by watching it on Netflix, because there's a specific moment in the film that's sort of confusing for movie and plot purposes. And I feel like if you're watching it at home, you might rewind it because you forgot something.
Yes,
and I
totally.
Think if you miss
a key element,
the movie for you.
Yes. I remember thinking in the theater, I can't even go to the bathroom because I know I'm going to miss four twists. Like, the movie keeps going.
Yeah.
It keeps, like, you know, it's like churning out, plot upheavals at every given moment. I also want to say, I think this is the first time I've seen Janelle Monáe in a movie where I would give her an A. She was really excellent in this movie. Like, Hidden
she
Figures.
She turned fuck out in this movie.
Yes,
no, this is her
really good
work.
Performance. Yeah, I think so, yeah. too. I think so, too.
Also, welcome back, Kate Hudson.
Oh, my gosh. No, I'm sick of having to rewatch that fucking clip from 9 for the millionth time. Let's, like, we have a new Kate Hudson movie where... I do think Glass Onion needs to give a few more comic opportunities to everybody in it. Like, everybody could have used 3 more funny moments. But Kate Hudson gets a couple of scream laughs, and we needed that from her.
Kate Hudson was really sort of channeling Goldie in the film, too. And I'm just sort of like, please come
yes.
back to us.
Right. Oh, what a lovely sentence. She sure was.
Anyway,
yes.
I love it. I love it. And, you know, like, going with the theme of talking about sight and sound this episode, like, I just, like, I still love seeing a movie in theaters, you know? And it's, honestly, it helps for, like, a movie like Jeannie Dillman or, like, I watched Drive My Car recently, too. And that was, I watched it for the first time on the plane back, but it felt like watching it in the theater only because, like, I didn't get Wi-Fi while I was watching it. So, like, I didn't
right.
have any other distractions while
you
watching.
Can be in the meditative space to watch it, yeah.
This era is the only time I'm ever going to really pay attention to it is if I'm sitting and with no fucking distractions. Like Isabel Huppert
yeah.
said.
Exactly.
No noise. No snacks.
No snacks.
Silence.
If that should be on French currency. Come on. Yeah.
Well, that's our episode. So thanks again to Jim Parsons for joining us this week. And we will be recording a mailbag episode soon. So send us your questions on social media or to keepitatcrooked.com. And of course, as always, remember to check out full episodes of Keep It on the Uncultured YouTube channel. And please rate and review Keep It on your podcast platform of choice, Apple, Spotify, Google Play, etc. 5-star reviews. If we gotta get 4 stars and we're not the number one diva, then I don't want it. To paraphrase Whitney. All right. We will see you next week.
Keep It is a Crooked Media production. Our senior producer is Kendra James. Our producer is Chris Lord. Our executive producers are Ira Madison III
and Louis Fertel.
Our editor is Charlotte Landis, and Kyle Seglin is our sound engineer.
Thank you to our digital team, Matt DeGroot, Nara Malkonian, and Delon Villanueva for production support every week.
Hi, my name is Mitch Landrieu.
My name is Erin Haynes.
My name is Jennifer Palmieri, and we're hosting a new series called Long Play. The South is the new political epicenter of the country. Democrats are way on their heels in this region. But Republicans are going through their own reckoning in the South, too.
I mean, the South has always shaped American politics. We know that.
The stakes could not be higher. But to win the South, you have to understand it.
People in the South feel really misunderstood, left behind, put down on, and they want to explain that to somebody.
We're traveling across six southern states to explore the people, the issues, the assumptions that no longer hold, and what the rest of us are missing about a region that will shape the future of our politics and our country. From Left, Right, and Crooked Media, starting July 27th, watch Long Play Series on YouTube at youtube.com/longplayseries or listen wherever you get your podcasts.